We're talking about stuttering, a neurological condition that affects the fluent and flowing production of speech. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer. Kent, glad you could be here. President Biden has lived with stuttering since childhood, and he's been open about what it's like to experience the anger and frustration of being mocked by classmates and even a teacher. Do you feel akin to Biden, determined over the years to control or to mask a stutter? What is that stigma like? Speech therapists, you join in too with insights, 800-642-1234. Brian Brown is an assistant professor of communication sciences and disorders at UW-Eau Claire. Brian, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
You are someone who has lived with a stutter since childhood. Can you start out by sharing your personal story about when it started and what this is like?
Sure. So I don't remember a time when I didn't stutter. From conversations with my parents, I've learned that my experience with stuttering followed a fairly typical trajectory, where I began to stutter around age three. And which is pretty typical for most children who stutter. They will begin to stutter in early childhood. And I kept stuttering, even though for most preschoolers who stutter, most of them will recover without intervention. About 20% of them will go on to stutter into adulthood, like me.
Yeah, I was wondering about that because, you know, do young kids who stutter early in life, do they automatically become adult stutters? It sounds like that's not the case.
No, and it's more likely that for preschoolers who preschoolers who stutter will recover, but for a sizable minority, they will persist to stutter.
What causes the stutter? What is happening inside the brain? Do scientists even know?
That is a great question, and we don't have one thing that we're able to say if a child has this, they will not stutter, but we know a lot about factors that can contribute to stuttering, and so things like language ability, things like motor ability, things like a family history, all combine together, and they it creates a unique sort of constellation of factors that can contribute to stuttering beginning or stuttering resolving in a given child. And these factors are not the same across individual children, but we can use them to look at a particular child and say this child is more likely to recover than another child. So, for instance, a little girl who begins to stutter very early, who has a family history of recovery, is more likely to recover than a boy who begins to stutter late and has a family history of persistence.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with UW-Eau Claire's Brian Brown. He's an assistant professor of communication sciences and disorders. We're talking about stuttering and what the science tells us and also personal stories. You can join in 800-642-1234. You know, Brian, President Biden lives with a stutter like you, developed during childhood like you. How do you see Biden and yourselves alike or dissimilar?
Well, I think that we share similar experiences in having to deal with the negative thoughts and emotions that frequently come along with stuttering. One way that we're different is I got therapy as a child, and to my knowledge, President Biden has not. And so I think that and we have very different professions, and I think partially because of that we take a very different response to managing our stuttering, where I am very comfortable stuttering openly, and President Biden is not. And and so I think that might be a little bit of a difference between us.
What are there technologies or techniques you've tried or seen over the years to increase fluency?
Sure. So when it comes to the therapy that we provide people who stutter, there are essentially two main ways to change speech in order to make it easier to talk. We can either work with the moments of stuttering, those disfluencies, and reduce physical tension just in those moments, or we can try to change physical tension throughout the entire utterance to make the moment of disfluency less likely to occur.
Mm-hmm.
So when working with the speech, it's really about reducing that physical tension, how much effort they're putting into speech. But we also have to think about managing those negative thoughts and emotions that go along with stuttering.
Well, let's bring in a call. Lindsay is joining us from Madison. Hi, Lindsay. What would you like to add?
Yes, I as a stutterer myself, I got speech therapy when I was about in middle school, which I would not suggest because that's a pretty awkward age to begin with. And I hated it. I guess my question is, and I think you already talked about this while I was talking to the screener, is there a genetic component, and does trauma, witnessing the trauma, does that make things worse? Cause I know, the more, nervous I am, like even talking on the phone and saying my name, surprisingly, can be very hard for me, and introducing myself can be very hard for me.
Oh, Lindsay, thank you so much for bringing this. Brian, what about trauma?
Yeah, well, so it's not likely that witnessing a particular event is going to cause stuttering, but we do know that for those little children, a shift in their in environment, maybe like the birth of a younger sibling, a death in the family, moving to a different house or home. A shift in their in environment can maybe be the trigger, but it's not necessarily the cause.
Yeah, yeah. So as you look forward here on the research and what, efforts, as Lindsay says, middle school was awkward for her to have mm-hmm. speech therapy. What are the developments, on the horizon?
That is a great question. One thing that we need is more research in stuttering therapy, because right now there's a lot of research looking into the brain and DNA to see if we can untangle what the genetics do to the brain to cause stuttering to emerge in the first place, and that's a very important question, but there isn't a lot of research going on into researching stuttering therapy. One area that we're moving that way in is looking at what components, in addition to the managing the tension of speech, where we can help. So we're beginning to look at things like acceptance and commitment therapy and cognitive behavioral therapy to bring alongside stuttering therapy to see if that can help manage those negative thoughts and emotions.
Brian, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Brian Brown is an assistant professor of communication sciences and disorders at UW-Eau Claire. Coming up, we continue our series of candidate interviews for Wisconsin's next state superintendent. We talk with the former assistant director at the State Department of Public Instruction. That is in a moment. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The nonpartisan primary election for the superintendent of public instruction, Wisconsin's top education post, it is 1 week away. Seven candidates are running in the primary ahead of the April 6th general election. Next in our series of interviews, it's Sean Hendricks, a former assistant director at the State Department of Public Instruction and former director of Governor Evers' Milwaukee office. What do you want to know about her priorities for public schools in our state? It's 800-642-1234. Sean, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for this opportunity. How are you today?
I'm doing well. Let's start with what you want, why you want this job. Why do you want to be Wisconsin's next state superintendent?
So I believe that I possess the experience, the education, the knowledge, and the disposition to close the achievement gap so that we can close the other gaps that are plaguing Wisconsin. Gaps such as the highest incarceration rate, the biggest gap in employment and unemployment and poverty, health disparities, all of that can be solved if we deal with education and give all students the right to a fully funded, equitable education.
How would you address Wisconsin's racial and economic disparities that are huge, that are vast, that divide student achievement across our state?
Absolutely. So a lot of it has to do with resources. Some of it has to do with our teaching core. And the other part has to do with our curricular choices and evolving parents. So as it relates to our funding, right now, we fund our schools inequitably. It's based on property tax values. And as such, some schools receive more funding than others. And our most neediest students don't receive the funding that they need. In the Vincent versus Voigt lawsuit, our chief justice has said that Wisconsin was failing in its obligation to educate students who live in poverty, students who have disabilities, and English language learners. The first thing that I'm going to do is set up a task force on school funding reform, and not the usual task force with a lot of, big people who have large roles. We are going to set up a task force with everyday people, with representatives from the rural, urban, and suburban areas, with parents, teachers, administrators, and businessmen on there to really look at our old tax formulas and come up with new ways. Now, the good thing about it is the Association on Equitable Funding has conducted quite a few research briefs on this, and they have put forth recommendations. And so my task force members are going to look at these recommendations and come up with their own recommendations, and we're going to take that to our elected officials. I have formed what I call my Bill of Rights for Wisconsin Students. And in this Bill of Rights, it clearly articulates what each of our students from K-3 through 12th grade will receive in their educational experience. Things such as early childhood education, which is very important. We know that students who experience early childhood education have a greater chance of reading on grade level by grade 3. In addition to that, our Constitution says that all of our students are supposed to receive a well-rounded education. And our legislature has defined a well-rounded education as not only our content areas, reading, writing, math, science, and social studies, but also our fine arts.
And I want to I just want to pause here on your Bill of Rights, because you mentioned K-3. Do you look at early childhood as K-3 and K-4, and how would you spread that around Wisconsin?
Yes, K-3 and K-4 is early childhood, and that would be funded through our new funded formula that I was telling you about.
Okay, yeah. Sean, when you look at the pandemic and the friction that we have, some students virtual, we have some schools totally in person, a mix of the both, how would you see it? What do you think schools should be doing in order to hold instruction virtually?
So I believe that schools have been doing the best they can. This pandemic came along without any notice, obviously. Our teachers had to pivot to virtual learning without training or any advanced preparation. You know, I believe that as we talk about returning all of our students to school, we need to follow one of my Bill of Rights, which says that students shall receive instruction by various modalities, face-to-face, blended, and virtual. And because of some of our students, like my son with special needs, may not be ready to go back to school because they have pre-existing conditions, or even when we think about students who have recently had a liver transplant and they're taking immune suppressant medications, their parents may not want them to go, but there are some students that are able to go. We need to have all three forms of instruction available. And in addition to that, we need to make sure that we equitably fund our schools so that they have PPE and all the materials that they need. Because once again, we don't equitably fund our schools currently. So we don't want a school to open up and they don't have the materials. But ultimately, I think that that's a decision that parents and teachers ought to be involved in and making, because they are the ones who are closest to our children.
We're talking with one of the seven candidates running for state superintendent. Sean Hendricks is here, a former assistant director of the state DPI and former director of Governor Evers' Milwaukee office. What questions do you have for the candidate? What do you want to know about her qualifications, her positions on issues regarding public education? 800-642-1234. Sean, how would you address, here in the pandemic, children falling further and further behind, some kids not ability to even connect due to broadband issues, or parents who need to work, child have to be self-directed at home? How do you catch these kids up?
So in my Bill of Rights, I also talk about making sure that we have additional options to meet the needs of students who have fallen behind by forming partnerships with community-based organizations to provide after-school programs or additional academic support. That academic support could be virtual as well. However, I understand for our urban areas, that is a problem with broadband, and that's something we need to work on.
Okay, so after-school support. In terms of summer school, what would your approach there? Some parents have been wondering, will there be summer school?
So I think that's a good idea. When I was district administrator here in Milwaukee, we had something similar to a community school where not only did we provide after-school academic services, we also had services during the summer and during spring and winter break.
When you look at the schools, and as you've been talking about the funding formula, which schools should receive more funding?
As I stated previously, those schools that serve students who have high numbers of children who live in poverty, students with disabilities, English language learners, and then also we need to consider weighted funding for our urban school districts who have densely populated areas for students, and our rural school districts where there's more sparsely populated students.
Let's bring in Ron now in Madison. Hi, Ron.
Hi, each student needs to be resuming education at the grade level where they can succeed. 85% probability of success, not based on age. There needs to be a comprehensive statewide exam that covers all the essential areas so that a student can actually succeed in school, graduate, and go on to a successful life.
Ron, thanks. What about standardized testing to place the students? Sean?
So I believe that, there are two purposes for standardized tests. In the state, we need to test our students like in grade 3, 8, and 10 to see how the state is doing and meeting the needs of our students. The other type of test is formative assessments, and those assessments are used by teachers to drive instruction and to figure out whether or not our students are learning the content that has been presented. That was very important when I was a district administrator at a school where we increased student achievement from 30% of the students who were reading on grade level to 70% of the students who were reading on grade level. And this was a district where 100% of the students were students of color and 99% qualified for free and reduced lunch. So we have to be very careful why we're using assessment and what that information is used for. Once again, I maintain that it should be formative assessment, should be used to form decisions about instruction, and then the summative assessment should be utilized so that the state has an idea of how our students are performing.
And we're out of time. Sean, thank you for joining us here on the Ideas Network. Here with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. COVID-19 has disrupted lives and killed hundreds of thousands of people across the country. But data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention shows that around 80% of people who get the illness have mild or moderate symptoms. WPR's Laura Pabin was in that second group of people. And with the help of some experts, she explored why that might have been harder than she expected.
Positive for COVID-19. That's what my lab results read. I was surprised. I felt totally normal. But I told everyone who needed to know. Only, I forgot one person. And he was now in the emergency room with COVID. I didn't know how to tell him, and I wasn't sure if I should tell him. This dilemma is real, and it's making the pandemic harder to control.
So we often see messaging, especially from elected officials, about this is not hard. Stop whining. Don't be selfish. Don't be reckless.
That's Julia Marcus. She's an infectious disease epidemiologist at Harvard Medical School.
My concern is that when people do test positive, that then they immediately feel like, oh, I must have been irresponsible. And that makes people afraid to disclose. So it actually ends up making the pandemic more difficult to contain.
For the record, I did end up telling the man that I had COVID. It was hard. Actually, everything about being COVID positive was difficult. Because isolating from my 9-month-old daughter wasn't an option for me, she had to quarantine and stay out of daycare longer than the normal 2 weeks. My husband and I work remote, so we made it work, but in a small apartment, it was stressful. It left my husband, Jake Connors, wondering.
It makes me think about what are other people going to do in a less advantageous situation when they're hit with that type of stuff. You know, we're lucky to be salaried employees. If you're not a salaried employee, why would you go get tested?
In other words, if you get paid by the hour and you get a positive test result, there goes that source of income. And in the likely event that your child has to stay home from school or daycare as a result, double whammy. But could this actually be deterring people from getting tested? I talked to Joffrey Swain. He's a recently retired UW public health professor. He headed up the Milwaukee Health Department for 26 years.
We do have significant data to suggest that not enough people are getting tested.
When we talked in late December, he said that only about half of Wisconsin's testing capacity was being used. The other indication that not enough people are getting tested?
Our positivity rate is high. So what it means is probably only the most serious cases are getting a test, and not enough people who have mild cases are getting a test.
Figuring out why is harder to pin down. Access to testing could be a reason. Being asymptomatic could be another. But some of it might be more nuanced. Kathleen Murphy-Endy, a clinical psychologist at UW Health, offered some insight from her own practice.
I think we sometimes underestimate the impact of finances on people's behavior with COVID. People don't have sick leave, perhaps. Maybe they can't take the time off work. Some people feel that no one has the right to tell them what to do.
Sometimes the reasons are more personal.
I think there's the guilt of having the possibility of infecting others. The thought of that guilt is pretty tremendous.
The federal government has depended on states to take the lead on controlling the virus. And experts say that's made it harder to control. Julia Marcus, the Harvard epidemiologist, says that now it feels like personal responsibility is what will save us. So we've resorted to shaming others for not following all the public health guidance around COVID, for being reckless. She says this isn't an effective way to change behaviors. All it does is drive it underground. I can attest to that. I didn't tell anyone when we ended my daughter's quarantine a few days early so that her grandparents could help watch her. We were struggling and needed support. We weighed the risks with the grandparents and collectively decided it was best for our family. On its face, following public health guidance around COVID sounds as simple as staying in and avoiding other people. But dismissing it as simple fails to consider the very human reasons why people act in other ways. I'm Laura Pavin.
And now the surge in firearms and ammunition sales. It's not unusual for gun sales to jump when a Democrat wins the White House. And in January, firearm sales soared. By the Washington Post's accounting of gun background check data, more than 2 million firearms were purchased last month. Michigan saw the largest percentage jump year over year. Did you buy a gun recently? Why and what will you use it for? Are you concerned about gun sales, or is this just cyclical, a product of the times? 800-642-1234. Mark Oliva is Public Affairs Director for the National Shooting Sports Foundation, which is a trade association for the firearm industry. Mark, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me today. I appreciate it.
What do you make of these numbers, the sharp increase in the number of purchases?
Well, these numbers really are eye-popping. They started back in March, which, of course, coincided with the onset of the coronavirus pandemic and the stay-at-home orders that we saw coming down from governors. March had the most background checks ever in a single month, and that was 2.3 million background checks for the sale of a firearm. We saw that continue through April and into May, and, of course, at the end of May, we saw the unfortunate death of George Floyd, and the protests that surrounded that very quickly morphed into rioting and looting and burning of cities. And that wasn't contained to just one city, and it wasn't contained to just one area. It was a national issue, and it was a national phenomenon that was going on. And people continued to buy firearms out of concern for their safety. And then, of course, we hit into the fall, where we started to see the campaign rhetoric ratchet up. And we had two very polar opposites of stances on firearms. We had President Trump, who was saying he was going to stand by your Second Amendment rights. And you had President Biden, who said that he was going to institute probably the most strident gun control programs that were ever introduced to the American voter. They started with, in July of 2019, of him standing on the debate stage and saying firearm manufacturers are the enemy. And it included him sitting down with Anderson Cooper and CNN and answering the question of whether he would confiscate lawfully owned semi-automatic AR-15 style rifles. And his answer was, bingo, yes, I will. So I think people reacted to that. And they were purchasing firearms, one, out of concerns for their own safety, but two, also concerns out of their ability to buy firearms that they wanted while they still could. So I think safety really was the driving factor throughout 2020, but certainly coming into 2021 and what we saw in January, as you just said, the 2 million background checks in January for the sale of a firearm, I think that really is a reaction to the concerns about gun control and how that would restrict Americans' ability to exercise their Second Amendment rights.
And so your narrative here really strings together, if you will, all of these national events and the talk coming from the leaders of our nation, former President Trump, current President Biden. Do we know who is buying all of these guns?
Yeah, so it's a really interesting question. So there's no national database where you can go to see that Mark didn't own a gun yesterday, but does own one today. That's against the federal law. 1986 Firearm Owner Protection Act says that you can't do that at the federal level. Now, certainly some states do have registries, but at a national level, it doesn't exist. So we surveyed our retailers in the summer to try and get an idea to be able to tell our members, our manufacturers and our retailers, who is buying firearms and why they're buying firearms. What we learned was that of the buyers in 2020, 40% were buying a gun for the very first time. That is a tectonic shift when we start to look at firearm owning and firearm purchasing behavior. based on the 21 million background checks for the entire year, that tells us over 8.4 million people bought a gun for the very first time. That also, that same survey also told us that 40% of the people who were buying guns in 2020 were women, and that the largest increase of any demographic group from 2019 to 2020 was among African Americans, and that rose 58%. So I try to put this in perspective. I'm a 47-year-old white guy who lives in the suburbs of Washington, D.C. Today's gun buyer looks a whole lot less like me and looks more like the rest of America.
Why is it not known exactly how many people own guns in our country or exactly how many guns there are in America?
Well, I think it's first is that it is against the law to have that firearm registry. So I think that is really, you know, your driving factor on not knowing that, because you have no centralized national database that's going to be able to collect that information. Again, the 1986 Firearm Owner Protection Act forbids the federal government from doing that. Now, Pew does do a survey annually of firearm ownership. And they
Pew
have
Research Center.
Pew mm-hmm. Research Center, exactly. And they have put out consistently that about one in three American households has a firearm in it. So that, you know, roughly comes out to about 100 million plus homes and have a gun in the home. Now, I think my suspicion on some of these surveys is a lot of gun owners actually self-select out of these surveys because firearm ownership is a very private issue. I think a lot of times that when these surveyors are reaching out to these individual homeowners or reaching out to these households to try and ask about guns, I think a lot of gun owners will self-select out and they won't answer the question. If you and I are going to have a conversation like we're having now about firearm ownership, I'll certainly talk to you about it. But if I get a cold call on my phone and asking me about my guns, I'm probably going to hang up. Yeah. And first out of concern is because I don't want to target my home and my family for possible crime for someone who may want to try to steal my guns. But two, as well as that's my private information. These are the tools by which I keep myself and my family safe. And I think a lot of gun owners feel the same way. So I think a lot of these surveys that we see that are produced annually are actually a little bit low on when it comes to firearm ownership. Interestingly, over the summer, we saw this happening time and again. Bill McGurn for the Wall Street Journal wrote an op-ed about buying a gun for the very first time. Now, Bill's a 59-year-old man living in northern New Jersey. He was a former speechwriter for George W. Bush, of course, now is on the editorial board for Wall Street Journal. But he penned a column, Confessions of a First-Time Gun Buyer.
I just want to pause there with you. Mark Oliva is with the National Shooting Sports Foundation. As we take a look at what's behind the spike in gun sales, how much do you think politics, the uncertainty of the pandemic, social unrest drive gun sales in America? Have you purchased a firearm recently? Where did you find the one you wanted? And what was inventory like? Did you have choices? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Mark Oliva here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Just a heads up on our programming. The Senate impeachment trial of former President Trump gets underway this morning with a debate and vote on the constitutionality of the trial. You can hear live coverage starting at 11 on the NPR News and Music Network of Wisconsin Public Radio or online at WPR.org. Right now, we're talking about firearm sales in America. We have Mark Oliva, Public Affairs Director for the National Shooting Sports Foundation. According to FBI data from 1998 to the present, a record number of background checks were performed last year, nearly 39.7 million in 2020. Did you purchase a firearm recently? What was the process like? 800-642-1234. And Mark Oliva is with us for 10 more minutes. Mark, we jumped in there. You were talking about what it was like for a first-time gun owner to share their perspective. Carry on.
Yeah, so we were talking about Bill McGurn, a columnist for the Wall Street Journal. He's actually on the editorial board. And he was talking about that he purchased a gun for many of the same reasons that we found in our survey over the summer as well, is he felt it was now time to be able to take responsibility for his personal safety and the safety of his loved ones. And that wasn't uncommon from what we found in our surveys. When we asked these retailers what people were telling them when they were purchasing their guns. They said overall they were buying guns out of concerns for personal safety. And that kind of it ties in with what we saw on two different other data points. Is one is when these spikes in the sales started. And they started during the coronavirus lockdown orders. And at the same time, we had police telling communities that they weren't going to be able to respond to every 911 call. And that obviously triggers people's concerns. Additionally, we also saw that through the type of firearm that people were buying, over half of the firearms that people were buying in 2020 were small defensive use handguns. And that's not atypical of any particular year. Defensive use handguns are by far the most popular selling firearms. But when we start to see this in such great numbers and coinciding with the great numbers of background checks, this tells us why people were buying the type of gun they were buying. Now, this isn't the type of firearm that you're going to use to go duck hunting, and you're not going to use it for deer hunting. They certainly would be terrible at that type of application, but they will serve the purpose for which they're designed, and that is to protect yourself either with concealed carry or self-defense in the home.
Yeah, you know, people opposed to gun control often have argued that they need firepower to protect themselves against criminals. How do gun owners prevent crimes?
Well, I think it becomes a matter of being able to prevent that personal crime against yourself. And if we look at even a very objective reporting of when it comes to police responding for a 911 call, the average response time is 7.5 minutes. So for 7.5 minutes, you are your own first responder. And I think that reality became clear to many Americans in 2020, especially when their police were saying, listen, we have to pull some of our own police force off of the street because they're becoming infected with COVID and we don't want to become vectors of infection within the community. So they were telling people, we're going to have to triage the 911 call. We're not going to be able to respond to everything. At the same time, you also had governors and mayors who were turning out prisoners out of the prisons for fear of contagion in those very confined spaces. Some of those prisoners were violent offenders, and some of those violent offenders were being rearrested literally within days of their release for the commission of another violent act. People saw this, and they took ownership of their Second Amendment right. Every American, every law-abiding American in America at birth has the right to be able to protect themselves. That is inherent with who we are, and it is codified and protected by the Second Amendment.
We're talking with Mark Oliva, who's the Public Affairs Director for the National Shooting Sports Foundation. We're discussing the spike in gun purchases last year. Have you become a first-time gun owner recently? What motivated you to buy your first firearm? And why do you think there is such an increase in gun sales? 800-642-1234. Mark, with the increase in gun sales, are you also seeing an increase in the number of people signing up for gun safety classes?
Absolutely. So I think probably two of the big concerns we've seen, obviously, is people are seeing that when they walk into their local gun stores that shelves are very, very bare. The display cases that would normally be full are empty and the walls are cleaned out. But also additionally with that is ammunition is very difficult to find right now. And that is for a couple of reasons. We've had an injection of 8.5 million people who weren't gun owners a year ago who now own a gun. And they're buying ammunition, but they're also buying range time. They're joining the local range and they're getting out to take classes. So where I'm at, and this is not atypical, range classes are booked out months in advance, sometimes upwards of 3 and 4 months. A lot of the first time buyer classes, a lot of the concealed carry permit classes, the 101 classes, especially some of the ladies only classes. Are all sold out months in advance.
So you can buy a gun through a retailer. What you say, inventory is very, very tight. How does it work to buy a gun through a private sale? And what do you see out of private sales and gun shows? Are these big sale opportunities?
Well, typically your gun shows will operate in the same manner as a retail sale. A lot of your retail sellers will attend those gun shows as well. So a retail seller will still have to complete the same background checks in the form 4473, which is required by the ATF, and then run that background check through the FBI the same way they would if they were selling that gun in the store. So there's no difference there. On a private sale, it really depends upon the state in which you're in. Now, the state I live in recently enacted universal background checks. So now any private sale will have to be facilitated through a firearm retailer, which will still include that form 4473 and a background check. If you're in a state that does not require a background check, then that private sale or that private transfer of a firearm is private business, and that is between you and that individual. Some states will have voluntary background checks where they can facilitate a background check through the state police department, but that is a state-by-state matter.
What happens if you lose your gun to a theft or otherwise? Do you report it stolen or missing?
We encourage everybody to report a gun that has been stolen or has gone missing. That firearm, if it is not in your possession, it must be accounted for. We actually have a program with the ATF where we will match rewards for gun thefts from retailers. For a lot of what we see, some of these smash and grabs where people are breaking into a gun store and stealing sometimes dozens of guns at a time. We work with the ATF to try and recover those firearms and bring those people to justice, because we understand that you're not stealing a gun to necessarily feed your family. You're stealing a gun to be able to perpetuate violent crime in that community, and we want to be able to stop it. That's why ATF has had this partnership with the National Shooting Sports Foundation for the past 20 years to do that. But on a personal level, some states will require you to do that, and we encourage everybody for voluntary notification right away, to make sure that their local police department knows if a firearm has gone missing from their home.
We heard from Matt in Wausau, who emailed to say that the NRA and Republican leadership have somehow convinced easily manipulated minds that Democrats will take away their guns. And this is a fear-based lie that sells a lot more guns. What would you say to Matt's comment there?
Well, I can't speak for the NRA, but I can tell you that what we've seen this year certainly is not a Republican-driven agenda to purchase firearms or to get people to be more active in firearm ownership. As we talked about Bill McGurn's commentary that he wrote this year, there was also a New York Times video op-ed piece that was released over the summer. And one of the women that was on that video op-ed piece was an African-American woman living in New York City who purchased her very first firearm. She had also campaigned with Michael Bloomberg as part of his Every Town for Gun Safety, gun control program. She was literally on the stage with Michael Bloomberg calling for stricter gun control. Well, the events over 2020 made her realize that she needed to be able to protect herself, and she bought a firearm for the first time. Again, we start to look at these numbers, 8.4 million people who purchased a firearm for the very first time, a 58% increase of African-American firearm ownership or gun buying activity between 2019 and 2020, and 40% of the people buying guns in 2020 being women. You can't tell me that all of these people are Republican white male voters. I think that we're starting to see is that firearm ownership is starting to really transgress. Span over some of these neat little boxes that sometimes some of the critics will want to put firearm owners into. And I think it's not so easily defined on who a firearm owner is. And I want to remind people, the Second Amendment isn't a white right or a black right or a red state right or a blue state right. It's a right of every American.
Mark, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Mark Oliva is Public Affairs Director for the National Shooting Sports Foundation, which is a trade association. Stay with us as we discuss the second impeachment of former President Trump with a historian who studies the evolution of the Republican Party. Do you think Trump will be convicted? What happens if he is acquitted? Your take on impeachment, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.